So one day, Satan decides to have a board meeting. And he summons together the princes of the demon ranks. And they meet together, and Satan says, "We need to get serious about seducing mankind. What will we do to woo humanity over to our side?" Who's got a plan? Demon number one speaks up and says, "I have a plan. I will go, and I will tell them that there is no heaven." Satan thought about it for a minute, rubbed his pointy goatee. "No, that will not work. God has placed eternity in the hearts of people, and they want there to be a heaven. That lie cannot be our main strategy." A second demon's piped up. "I will go, and I will tell them there is no hell." Again, Satan reflected, and again he shook his head. "No, they know there is a Hitler, and so they are sure there must be a hell." And then a third demon spoke up from the legal division. And he said, "I will go, and I will tell them there is no hurry." And at that, the meeting was adjourned, and Satan had settled on a strategy. "I will tell them there is no hurry." What's the rush? Why do people get in such a tizzy about this whole religion thing anyway? We can get that sorted out in the next phase of our life. Right now, I'm focusing on getting my degree from Stanford. This is important. I'm only here for 4 years. Got to get the credits. Got to get the stuff. Got to build my resume. Got to build the connections. Got to network. I'm in the MBA program. This guy might be a CEO. Got to get to know him. I can worry about this when I get married. Well, we got to focus on our marriage right now. You know, I'll worry about this when I have kids. I'll try and raise them right. Wow, parenting. So when my kids graduate, when they leave home, when I become a grandparent, when I'm on my sickbed, when I die, what's the hurry? What's the big deal about anyway? I've gotten interesting reactions from people when I've told them that this week we're talking about sloth. We're continuing our series on the seven deadly sins. Number four is sloth, right there in the middle. Before I even began the series, I did surveys of students. I just walk up to people and say, "Hey, you got a few minutes? Do you know what the seven deadly sins are?" They're thinking, weird conversation. Do you know what the seven deadly sins are? I usually get a representative list of five, six of them, usually. Always the one that was left off, there was one left off, seemed to be sloth. I'd ask people follow-up questions like, if you had to condense the list, you know, down from seven to six, what are the six deadly sins? Which one gets the boot? Almost unanimously, sloth, definitely. It's like Sesame Street. One of these things is not like the other. It just doesn't seem to fit in the list. And, you know, or I'd say, which one do you understand least? Sloth. Which one do you think is least relevant to Stanford students? Sloth. Sloth is the big question mark over the seven deadly sins for most people here on the farm. And I find that fascinating because I've come to the conclusion that sloth is probably one of the most endemic sins to the Stanford culture. And I will stand by that and defend it to you publicly. In fact, I intend to do so in just a few moments. The reason that there is such confusion about the nature of sloth is because the word has migrated in meaning over time. It's sort of like the word gay. You say that word 100 years ago, very different images in your mind than today. You're like, "Hey, you want to go to a gay pride parade?" To, like, you know, some pope back then. Like, "That sounds great. Let's have a happiness parade." Today, very different scenario that you're proposing. Same thing with sloth. It is a word that has not migrated quite as far, but has shifted its context. And you can even see that in the history of the church. I mentioned a few weeks ago that Evagrius of Pontus was the first monk to have written down the list of eight deadly sins that has gone on to become the list of seven that the church talks about today. And it's interesting, his list did not include anything that would be translated as sloth. Instead, it included two words, acedia and tristitia. I think I pronounced that last one right. Basically, apathy and despair, or apathy and sadness. Over time, the church decided to sort of consolidate down to seven, because seven is a more holy number, for some reason. And so they decided to kick one of the eight sins out, and actually vainglory got combined with pride, and then acedia got rolled into sadness, and they added envy to the mix for a total of seven. And so acedia was gone, sadness was in vogue, until the 17th century, the church is like, you know what? Calling sadness a sin just seems kind of wrong. Maybe what we're trying to get at is better expressed by the word sloth than it was for a season. Until we come to today and everybody's like, naps? God gets mad about naps? murder doesn't make the list, and naps is a deadly sin. What is up with that? I think that if we trace back to the original concepts of acedia, of apathy, and of despair, that we're going to see that this is actually an extremely relevant sin to our day-to-day lives. Let's start with apathy. I don't know if you have ever actually studied the sloth, the animal. It's a really kind of bizarre beast, kind of weird looking first. It's got these big long hooks on the end of its arm, lives upside down on a tree, barely ever comes down to the ground. Your typical sloth only has half as much muscle mass as any other animal of its size, or the average animal of its size. Your typical sloth's weight, two-thirds of it comes from the contents of its belly. And it takes it as much as a month to digest a meal. Now, this is a mammal we're talking about, not a reptile that's waiting for heat to help it out. I mean, this is by design. Also, your typical sloth will only go to the ground about once a week to poop and to pee. If you're wondering why, it does everything else. It like gives birth up there, does everything else up there. Why does it go down to poop and pee? It hangs upside down. I said it was lazy, not stupid. but once a week, goes down to poop and to pee. This last fact, though, is what grabbed my attention about the sloth. I mentioned it gives birth up there. Baby sloths come out, they hang on to their mother. They grab onto the fur. Now, every once in a while, something will happen, like a loud noise, or a predator comes by, or there's a big wind, or something strange, a storm, and a baby sloth falls off. Often that sloth will die because its mother is not willing to go to the ground and retrieve it. What's the hurry? You know what? I'm not due to poop for another 3 days. That kid will still be there when I head down. And if not, what's the big deal? Apathy. Apathy, not caring about things that you really ought to care about. Apathy is actually, I believe, the dominant religion on this campus. It's not atheism, it's apatheism. It's not caring about God. It's not caring about religion. It's just thinking, whatever you want to believe, it's good for you. Probably. Maybe. Doesn't matter. Evagrius actually considered acedia, which I'm translating as apathy. It's not an exact translation. It's pretty close. Most theologians still use the word acedia, A-C-E-D-I-A, because it's got some nuances that are hard to bring into English with the current vocabulary we have. But basically, he described it to be the third worst sin of all. You had pride, you had vainglory, which is like a type of pride, and then you had acedia, apathy. You had not caring. He describes in a very interesting passage some attributes of acedia. How can you tell as a monk out in the desert, which is what he was, if you're wrestling with acedia? Since none of you are monks out in the desert, I've kind of updated his list and changed it slightly. But this is basically straight out of a 4th century author. This is how you can tell. You get bored with spiritual activities. For instance, prayer becomes empty and hollow to you. You find that the Bible reads more like a phone book than a love letter from God. If you have a fight with a friend, it feels like it'd be easier to form a new friendship than to try and patch up the old one. In sentences like, "You know what? I can worship God anywhere. Why should I go to church anyway?" begin to make a lot of sense in your head. Apathy is rising in your soul. Apathy towards God. Apathy towards the things that ought to matter most in life. Pop quiz. What would you say is the opposite of love? Almost automatically, most Americans, at least, say hate. But most thoughtful people that I know, if I ask them what's the opposite of love, will pause for a moment or two and then say something like apathy or indifference. Because at least hate says you matter. You're worthy of attention and emotional energy. Apathy says, you can like me, you can hate me, I don't care. You're nothing more to me than the piece of gum on my shoe. You just don't matter at all. That's why apathy in the final analysis is such a big deal on the sin list. Because love is the foundation of all Christian morality. What did Jesus say when he was asked, you know, what's morality all about? What's morality all about? He said, love God, love your neighbor. Apathy strikes at the heart of love. In fact, apathy is the enemy of two of the three core Christian virtues, which are faith, hope, and love. Apathy undermines faith, and it eliminates love. How? I think it's summarized or expressed in a pretty famous story from the Bible. Jesus has at this point been betrayed and arrested, and he's just been brought before a man named Pontius Pilate. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Is that your own idea?" Jesus asked. "Or did others talk to you about me?" "Am I a Jew?" Pilate replied. "It was your people and your chief priests who handed you over to me. What is it you have done?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jews. But now my kingdom is from another place." "You are a king then," said Pilate. Jesus answered, "You're right in saying I'm a king. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me." "What is truth?" Pilate asked him. With this he went out again to the Jews and said, "I find no basis for a charge against him. It's your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of Passover. Do you want to release the king of the Jews?" And of course the crowd screams no. And love incarnate is tortured to death. Apathy. Pilate is the very model of apathy. I mean, look at this. He has concluded that Jesus is an innocent man of the charges that are brought against him. First, he didn't want anything to do with it. At the beginning, he's like, what, why in the world am I dealing with it? Go try this man yourself. Well, we can't put anybody to death. They're not even telling him what the charges are. He's like, go away. I don't care if he's do something. And then they force him to deal with Jesus. He pulls Jesus over and says, "All right, look, they want me to put you to death. They say they can't. Probably, what, you're a rebel? You're a king? Are you a king?" And he's like, "If I was a king, would I be here in front of you? Wouldn't I have like soldiers like beating up your soldiers?" "Yeah, I guess that makes sense. So what are you then?" "I'm a king of truth. I'm a king of sorts." "Oh, truth. That's interesting. Bye." And Jesus says, everyone who cares about truth will listen to what I have to say. "Oh, that's nice. End of interview." Goes out. "Look, this man's innocent. Should I let him go?" "This man is innocent. Should I let him go? Or should I let the lynch mob decide what to do with him?" Apathy. And because of his apathy, love was killed. Now, that's not the only way that Pilate expressed apathy that day. The way that he expressed apathy most profoundly to me, and most amazingly, is the same way that apathy is expressed every day on this campus. Three words. What is truth? I can hear it right now in the dorm rooms. "You know, I'm glad that Jesus thing is working out for you. I'm not that interested. Thanks. Maybe some other time." Apathy. Apathy. I can hear it in the classroom right now. Now, it's important as we study world civilizations to remember that we've got no standing point from which to judge another culture's sense of values or another person's personal code of ethics. And Pilate echoes through the ages. What is truth? I can hear it in the cafeteria. "You know, maybe there's a God, maybe there's not. It's really no skin off my nose. Look, if there is, I hear he's a nice guy. I'm sure we can work something out when I get up to the pearly gates. I'd just rather live in the here and now, if you don't mind. Keep your religion to yourself, and I'll keep my opinions to myself." Apathy. Apathy, as I said, is, in my opinion, the dominant religious worldview on this campus. And can you see how it is absolutely deadly as a sin? It is guaranteed to cut you off from God and to cut you off from other people. Apathy is bad news. And that's only half of sloth. The other half is despair, despondency, what the church called sadness for a while and decided to change it. A famous philosopher called Soren Kierkegaard, you may have heard of him, he's the father of existentialism. You may not realize he was a devout believer, wrote a lot about God and Jesus. In fact, he wrote a book called The Sickness Unto Death. And The Sickness Unto Death is a quote from the Bible, or it's actually a tweaked quote from the Bible. It's from the Gospel of John, where Jesus is summoned to go and see his friend Lazarus. And Jesus says, "This sickness will not end in death." Which is interesting because Lazarus then dies, but Jesus brings him back to life. And so Kierkegaard begins thinking, that's not a sickness that leads to death. What is a sickness that ends in death? And he comes to one conclusion. Despair. Despair is a sickness that ends in death. Most famously in the Bible, Matthew 27, starting in verse 3. When Judas, who had betrayed Jesus, saw that he was condemned, he was filled with remorse and returned the 30 silver coins to the chief priest and the elders. "I have sinned," he said, "for I have betrayed innocent blood." "What is that to us?" they replied. That's your responsibility. Apathy. So Judas threw the money into the temple and left. Then he went away and hanged himself. Why did he hang himself? Sorrow. He let sorrow get the best of him. The thing that is so deadly about despair, when you give yourself over to it, is it cuts off any possibility of forgiveness or redemption. You just shut yourself off. I am a lost cause. I mentioned earlier that apathy sins against faith and against love. When you bring in despair, you get the full trifecta. Because despair rules out hope. If you are filled with sloth in the classical understanding, you can have neither faith nor hope nor love. You cannot be a child of God at all in any meaningful sense of that word. You cannot be seeking to honor God with your life because you have eliminated the core Christian virtues from your life. It's interesting to compare Judas and Peter. Contrast, really. You see, Judas is the one who betrayed Jesus to death, but Peter is the one who denied Jesus publicly 3 times. Said, "I don't even know the man." And it says also that Peter went away after the third betrayal, the third denial, and he wept bitter tears. He and Judas are in the same place. They've both done wrong. They both are seized with sorrow. Judas yields to his sorrow, to his sadness, to his despondency, and allows it to overtake him. And it ends in his death. Peter looks at his sorrow, holds on to it, but seeks community. Judas isolates himself. Peter surrounds himself with friends, the other apostles, and thus he is prepared, when Jesus comes to offer him forgiveness, to receive the forgiveness that Jesus offers. And 3 times he's given a chance to profess his love for Jesus, even as 3 times he had denied his awareness of Jesus. It's a powerful contrast. Absolutely amazing. But when you despair, when you've just given up, you have turned your back on one of the cornerstones of the Christian faith, which is hope. Faith, hope, and love. Without them, we are nothing. We are certainly nothing that God wants anything to do with. As I said, I think properly understood, sloth, the combination of apathy and despair, or really I should say an apathy that grows into despair, most commonly, is one of the most widespread sin of the 7 deadly sins here at Stanford. And again, I want to emphasize something about these. The technical term is not the 7 deadly sins, it's the 7 capital vices. These are things that are not necessarily always sinful in and of themselves, but they're things that give rise to sinfulness more often than not, and at times can themselves be sinful. Why am I convinced this is such a widespread sin here at Stanford? Well, one thing, looking around, talking to students, asking people what they think. Another is just reflecting on my own life since I moved here to the Bay Area. In many ways, I wrestle with sloth more than I wrestle with any of the other sins. I began this meeting in the announcement time by saying, we're going to spread this list around to help us pray for one another. You know, my first 2 years here, I prayed for every student in the ministry of Chi Alpha every day. Some of you have spent the night at my house over, say, summer break, and you went into the shower, you know, and you saw that I had a little laminated list with everybody's name on it. And I would just go down that list every morning in the shower. You know, I'm not doing anything productive other than lathering up. It's not that challenging to my gray matter. It can do other things. And so I would just go down. It was a reminder. I would pray. And I prayed every day for every person in Chi Alpha. This year, I just haven't. I stopped. Why? Did something happen in my life to preoccupy my shower time? No. I'm just in there now, and I'm just, you know, singing songs about the news. I don't know. Anxiety of the day. I just stopped praying. Why? You know what? I can't lay it at the feet of anything other than apathy. Not so much apathy towards you guys, but apathy towards prayer. Just having stopped believing at a real level. You know, real beliefs manifest in behavior, right? Having stopped believing at some real level that praying for you matters, that it actually makes a difference. And this is despite the fact that I know at a cerebral level that as a minister, it's a big deal that I do this. It says in 1 Samuel 12:23, Samuel speaking to the people, he says, "Far be it from me that I should sin against God by not praying for you," the people to whom he's called to minister. But you know what? My sloth has gotten the better of my intellect. Not uncommon. How many people here, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but just internally, think it's probably a good idea to read the Bible regularly? How many more people think it's a good idea to read the Bible regularly than actually do read the Bible regularly? Because it's just easy to let it slide. happens in my marriage. You know, I can think of things I could do that would enhance my relationship with my wife. But then I ask myself, at some subconscious level, what's the hurry? Maybe I can do it after retreat, or after this trip, or after this next big thing coming up that's taking up my time right now. Then I'll spend more time with Paula. Then Dana and I will play this game. Then whatever will happen. Apathy. Despair. Despair that I can make a difference in my own character. You know, there are things in my life I see that I'm not proud of. You know, on one level I sort of wish they'd change, but on a deeper level, the level that's actually driving my behavior, I've sort of resigned myself to saying, you know what? I'll always be disorganized, or I'll always be whatever, fill in the blank. Despondency. Now, what have I done when I do that? I've cut off any real chance of God moving that area of my life. Because even if he tries to move, I'll ignore him. I've given up. I'm not even looking. My antenna is not only not up, it's like retracted into itself, like a turtle's neck back into its shell. Maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm the only one in this room who really wrestles with not caring enough about God and about things that will help me draw closer to God. Perhaps. I doubt it, but you never know. There is a really, really interesting verse in the Bible that I never even really understood until I was preparing this message on sloth. I mean, I understood what it meant, but I didn't understand how it fit into the whole theological construct. It's James chapter 4, verse 17. Anyone then who knows the right thing to do and fails to do it commits sin. See, that's what makes apathy so different, or I should say sloth, so different from every other sin. The reason it doesn't fit neatly into the seven deadly sins, the other ones are things you do. I'm actively envious of something in your life. I actively am lustful of this person. I am angry with this situation or whatever. I am proud of myself for this accomplishment in my life. It's an active thing. This is a negation. It's a sin of omission, not a sin of commission. And that means in some ways it's the biggest one of all. Because we all do far less than we know we should. I actually read one comedian while I was preparing for this. He said, I love sloth. It's my favorite sin because it's the only one you can commit while you're unconscious. which I think is misunderstanding a little bit, going back towards the laziness side of things, which is included, but more on the nap end. But it gets at something. It's so easy. It's so easy to fall prey to the vice of sloth. So I'd like to ask you to join me in repenting tonight of not loving enough. Dante, in his breakdown in the Divine Comedy of the Seven Deadly Sins, in Purgatio, he breaks down the seven sins into seven levels where you're punished for each one. He divides three into perverted love, loving things wrongly. For example, pride, loving yourself in an inappropriate way. You ought to have self-love, but not that kind of self-love. He divides some into excessive love for the wrong things, greed, and excessive love of money. But there's one that stands alone, sloth. Insufficient love. You just don't love enough. He visualizes, he pictures it as though you're weighted down by things and your love's not strong enough to lift them off, to care. Tonight I ask you to join me in repenting for not loving enough. But maybe you don't need to. Ask yourself, what's the hurry? Satan would love it if you did.